From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Once old Yankee Stadium closes, wither the ghosts of Ruth, Mantle, Gehrig, and DiMaggio, and Joe Pepitone. Don't forget the ghost of Joe Pepitone. Ahead on Only a Game, Yankees fans say goodbye to their old ball yard. Also, a WNBA playoffs update and a conversation with Jeff Perlman, author of Boys Will Be Boys, The Glory Days and Party Nights of the Dallas Cowboys Dynasty. Also ahead, racing pigs go for the gold. In this case, baked goods.
It's a 150-foot track. They run around roughly 7 seconds. After a couple times, they know what's there, and the first one there is going to get the whole cookie. The loser's going to get the crumbs. That's just a fact of life.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Tomorrow night's finale at the old Yankee Stadium will be a battle for the bottom of the standings between the Bronx Bombers and the Baltimore Orioles. With no postseason bliss on the October horizon, Yankees fans have been visiting the 85-year-old baseball shrine this week to say farewell to the house that Ruth built. Only a Game's Kirk Carapeza was there, and he has our report.
Before Tuesday's game against the Chicago White Sox, a game the Yankees will lose 6-2 before a home crowd of 52,000, fans file into Yankee Stadium. They're longtime local fans, as well as members of the Yankees diaspora. They're wide-eyed kids and adults, like Matthew Middleton, a 38-year-old attorney who grew up on Walton Avenue, just around the corner from the stadium.
The first Yankee game I ever went to was actually the 77 World Series. In the seventh inning, some police officers let us in the bleachers when we were little kids, and that was the first game I ever saw.
Middleton, who sports a button-down Yankees jersey, is showing his five-year-old son, Makai, where he and his buddies entered the stadium that night 31 years ago. That's when he fell in love with the game, and he hopes to pass his Yankees passion on to Makai.
He probably doesn't appreciate it now, but I'm sure he will in the future.
Middleton says this may be the last time he goes to the stadium with his son, who wears a matching pinstripe jersey. But
I have a few friends who have connections, so I may come back on Sunday.
He says he has mixed emotions about the new stadium.
What I could compare it to is moving out of a house that you grew up in, that you've been living in for 30 years. Like, all your memories are there. So, you know, it's a big difference moving out of it. It's going to be, like, sentimental. It's going to be emotional. It's going to be sad.
Orlando Cabrera.
Jim Joyce and his wife Claudia have brought their sons Henry and James to the old ball yard one more time. But after a rough fourth inning for the Yankees, they decide to leave. It's bedtime for the boys. Looking at the new stadium across 161st Street, Jim says it's tough to leave the old stadium, but he's looking forward to taking his family to the new one.
It's got all the best of the old one in it. They say, you know, there's plenty of the luxury boxes and all the realities of modern times, but if that's what it costs to put a great team on the field, I'm all for it.
Bob Bolgan, a retired police officer, is not all for it. He caught a game earlier this week with some friends, and he and his son have tickets for the final game on Sunday night.
You know, there's so much history in this building. I wish they could have renovated it. You know, I've seen the pictures of the new stadium, and you know, I mean, I know it's going to be grand, but, you know, I just keep thinking about the history here.
He's also thinking about the ghosts. Ruth, Gehrig, DiMaggio, Munson, Mantle, Maris. Standing outside Gate 2 on 161st Street, Bolgan's not so sure those ghosts will make the move.
We'll see. Well, we went from the house that Ruth built, and now we're going into the house that Jeter has. So we'll see what happens.
The old stadium has been good to the Yankees. They've won 26 world championships here, but for the first time in 13 seasons, the team is not playing into October. And that's left a few more seats open for fans from across the country who've descended on the Bronx this month to say goodbye.
That one right there in a large and an extra large. Yes, please.
At Stadium Souvenirs on River Street after Tuesday's game, Scott Jones, an aspiring actor from Los Angeles, tries to find the right t-shirt to commemorate the old stadium.
No, none of them? Okay, what about in that one right there? Yeah.
Jones is pointing to a blue and white t-shirt that reads, Yankee Stadium, final season, 1923 to 2008.
None either? No, the two over?
Jones is here to see his first and his last game at the stadium. He says there's no modern comparison to the Yankees leaving.
No, it's like the Romans leaving the Coliseum.
Above the souvenir store, the L train platform is brimming with people waiting to return home after the game. To the north is the new stadium, just a Johnny Damon throwaway. Amy Scannapico, a lifelong Yankees fan who grew up in Brooklyn, waits for the train.
My father was a Yankee fan. I was born a Yankee fan. I have no choice. That was it.
She's trying to ignore the new stadium looming over her right shoulder. Instead, she prefers to remember the first time she came to the old stadium. She says it was surreal.
I was 5 and my dad took me, and all I remember is the lights. Just so bright. Brighter than I've, you know, ever seen before. It was awesome.
As Scannapico boards the 4 train south, those lights are now turned off. She and a few other fans on board have tears in their eyes.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
The train picks up speed and heads south, around the bend, past the house that Ruth built, and into a dark September sky. For Only a Game, I'm Kirk Carapeza in the Bronx.
The first round of the WNBA playoffs is underway. Tonight in San Antonio, the Silver Stars will host the Sacramento Monarchs, and the New York Liberty will visit the Sun in Connecticut. Joining me now to discuss the best of three conference semifinals and various other WNBA matters is Clay Callum of Full Court Press. Clay, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's always a pleasure, and it's one of the best times of the year for women's basketball
fans.
Well,
it's a busy time, if nothing else. Before we get to the playoff matchups, I want to discuss some off-court statistics. The WNBA says attendance was up a couple of points this season, TV ratings were up almost 20%, and merchandise sales were up 36%. Should the league take a break in the middle of its schedule and send its players to an international tournament every summer?
Well, there's a couple of things. First, I hate to be negative, but I do think that the attendance numbers might have been cooked a little bit. The league has been noted to have had some late season surges in attendance that coincidentally pushed them just past last year's figures. That said, however, the TV ratings and the merchandise sales and also the hits on the website are all way up. So I think there was some generation of interest from the Olympics, but also I think the WNBA has been around a long time now, and I think its fan base is slowly growing.
One team's worth of WNBA players returned from Beijing with gold medals, and Becky Hammon came home with a bronze medal, having played for Russia's team. Are we likely to see more U.S. players helping out other countries in the future?
It's certainly possible. Hammon, in the end, will probably make 7 figures for having signed her contract with Russia, gotten her Russian citizenship. It's going to allow her to make more money in Europe from here on out throughout her career. My understanding is the only way they were going to give her the Russian citizenship was if she played in the Olympic Games. It had always been her dream to play in the Olympic Games. So the combination of the two created a unique opportunity for Becky. I think you will see African players have done so before, people with dual citizenship, but I don't think you'll see that many of her caliber.
All right, on to the postseason. The Silver Stars defeated the Sacramento Monarchs on Thursday night, thanks in part to the aforementioned Becky Hammon. Does anything change when those two teams play in San Antonio tonight?
It just gets harder for the Monarchs. First, I have to give credit to Jenny Busek for doing a wonderful coaching job with a roster that, if you look at it objectively, is probably better only than Atlanta's in the entire league. And yet, they made the playoffs, and they had some big wins down the stretch. But then, Rebecca Brunson, their top front court player, got hurt, hasn't played the last 2 regular season games, didn't play Thursday, won't play this weekend. The Monarchs are just horribly undermanned. It's going to be very, very hard for them to win down there.
In the other Western Conference series, the Seattle Storm host the Los Angeles Sparks tomorrow. Seattle minus Lauren Jackson has been good enough to reach the playoffs, but will the Storm be able to win 2 straight games in her absence?
It's really hard to say. That's a very interesting series. Los Angeles has tremendous talent, but the rumors are that the team doesn't exactly bond. 12 players, 12 cabs, maybe. This could be a problem for the Sparks. Brian Egler's a wonderful coach. Sue Bird's playing as well as she ever has in her, really, her WNBA career. She's really playing at a very high level right now.
Regarding the Sparks, Clay, this week the WNBA announced its Peak Performers Awards, which go annually to the league's leading scorer, rebounder, and assist leader. Are you surprised Candace Parker didn't hit for the triple?
She certainly had a great, great season as a rookie. She's really stepped in and done the kinds of things that everyone expected her to do. Yeah, the triple-double, though, is asking a lot, even of a player as talented as Candace. It would help a little, of course, if any of the guards could make outside shots, but that leaves more shots for her.
The Connecticut Sun and New York Liberty are playing in one of the Eastern Conference semifinals. Connecticut looked flat at the end of the regular season and flat again in the first game of this playoff series, which they lost to the Liberty. Are they fit for the postseason?
I'd have to be a little nervous if I were a Connecticut Sun fan. They didn't look good. But on the other hand, New York did everything right. They made every three-pointer. Shamika Kristen-Banks in a three-pointer. Janelle McCarville's going all over the place making great plays. And yet, at Madison Square Garden, the Liberty only win by 9. That's as well as New York can play in a lot of ways. And so that sort of gives some optimism to Connecticut. On the other hand, sooner or later, you got to win.
The other Eastern Conference semifinal series has the Detroit Shock up 1-0 against the Indiana Fever. Some of the experts have Detroit not only winning the East, but winning the championship this time around. Is that the way you think it'll work out?
I think that they'll get to the finals. I don't think Indiana really has the firepower to win the series. San Antonio is very good. They're a very balanced, well-coached team. They have a lot of weapons offensively. They have a lot of weapons defensively. To just say, oh, yes, Detroit's going to sail on to the WNBA title, I think really is asking a lot. And it's also important to remember that last year, those were three tough games against New York in the semifinals. Detroit had to win in overtime just to reach the WNBA finals last year. So I wouldn't write anything down in pen yet, maybe in pencil.
Clay Callum of Full Court Press joins me several times during each WNBA season. Clay, thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Bill.
I'm just a humble radio host, born in the days when enraptured families sat together before the softly glowing Philco set. Your modern world of streaming media and MP3s frightens and confuses me, but that doesn't mean you have to feel the same way. To access podcasts of Only a Game, please go to onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Last Saturday in Milwaukee, Holler House celebrated its 100th anniversary. Featuring two lanes and a bar, Holler House Tavern is the oldest bowling establishment in the United States, at least according to the U.S. Bowling Congress. Matt Hersel first came to Holler House 32 years ago when he was 17. Of the clientele, he said, "You didn't come here to party. Guys here were tough as nails." The same might be said of the current owner of the fabled lanes, Marcy Skoronski. At a celebration, Ms. Goronsky, who is 82, was asked if she'd considered retiring. "Nope," she said, "I'm going to die behind the bar."
Roll out the barrel, we'll have a barrel of fun. Roll out the barrel, we've got the blues on the run.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, 11 Olympians and Stamps. But first, Jeff Perlman's new book, Boys Will Be Boys, is subtitled The Glory Days and Party Nights of the Dallas Cowboys Dynasty. It could as easily have been subtitled Sex and Drugs and Super Bowls, almost certainly in that order. Jeff Perlman joins me now from the studios of NPR West. Jeff, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks. How do you stole my the title I wanted. How do you know about that?
How come you didn't get the title you wanted? Your publisher had a problem?
I'm just an author. I'm not going to lie about this. The title I wanted for the book, I had a working title called Scissors to the Neck. Because
oh,
the first
nice.
Chapter is about, and I thought it was kind of dramatic and blah, 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 but I got overruled by everyone, including my wife.
Well, as you say, you begin the book with a story of receiver Michael Irvin stabbing a teammate in the neck with a pair of scissors in 1998, and you end the book with Irvin preaching redemption and righteousness at the Football Hall of Fame 9 years later. To what extent is the story of the Cowboys of that era the story of Michael Irvin?
Oh, I think very, very, very much. I think it really, they mirror him. I mean, you know, first of all, he was incredibly talented. And those Cowboys with Emmitt and Aikman and Irvin and Charles Haley and Darren Woodson and Deion Sanders, they were incredibly talented as well. And they played hard. Irvin, during night practice in 1995, it's a really hot day and the Cowboys go long. They go 2 hours. And after the practice is over, everyone else goes in. And Mike Irvin says to a quarterback, hey, let's go in that backfield and work out. And in the middle of running routes, Mike Irvin throws up all over himself and doesn't even flinch, keeps running, keeps working. And that team was like that. They were hard workers. And yet, at the same time, lived a very, very, very wild and sort of hard life off the field with a lot of women and a lot of drugs and a lot of infidelity. And it's kind of who they were.
One of the other characters you just mentioned who stands out in your account of excesses among the Cowboys is Charles Haley, who especially enjoyed exposing himself to his teammates and bullying rookies. On one creative day, he cut the roof off a teammate's car and urinated into it. Did this sort of behavior alarm anybody in the organization or encourage anybody to think maybe Charles Haley needed some professional help?
He had professional help. You know, he was on antidepressants. The problem was nobody was there to tell him you might want to take the antidepressants every day. So he would take them one day, not take them 3 days. Take them one day, not take them 5 days. And he never picked on the Emmitts or Troys or Michaels. He always picked on the lower guys. And there was a defensive lineman named Chad Hennings, a very squeaky clean guy out of the Air Force Academy, who Haley used to beat on mercilessly. And one day, finally fed up, Hennings, who was 6'6", you know, a giant of a man, grabs Haley around the neck and pushes his head out the window and says, if you ever mess with me again, I will kill you. And I think a lot of players felt that way about him. But there was, you know, the guy produced. He was the difference between a playoff team in 91 and a Super Bowl team in 92. He was one of the most prolific pass rushers of his generation. So I think at the end of the day, Jerry Jones and Jimmy Johnson and Barry Switzer were willing to sort of tolerate it all.
To what extent were the Cowboys who didn't indulge in various illegal and dangerous excesses on a nightly basis concerned that the miscreants were making it harder to win football games?
You know, I focus a lot of the book on one guy. They had a middle linebacker named Robert Jones, a kid out of East Carolina who comes from this absolutely horrible background. Horrible. His father killed his mother when he was 3 months old. And in fact, he was sitting on her lap at the time she was shot. He shot her in the chest. And he had several brothers who ended up in jail, committing crimes, dying. And his whole goal, his entire life, his one goal was to become a dad and have kids and sit down for Christmas dinner and sit down for Thanksgiving and open the gifts beneath the tree. He gets to the Cowboys and there's all this pressure. You know, if you were a Dallas Cowboy in those days, you were supposed to go out to strip clubs. You were supposed to cheat on your wife. You were supposed to live the life. You were supposed to ride high. And if you didn't, if you had the audacity to say, be loyal to your wife, or the audacity to not want to smoke a joint, you were mocked and you were ridiculed. And I think there were guys on that team, not that many, who felt sort of burdened by the expectations of you're supposed to be a certain way, you're supposed to live the life, and it wasn't the life they particularly wanted to live.
How different are things now in Dallas with the Cowboys than they were during the 90s?
I don't think you could be the way the Cowboys were in the 90s now. I don't think it would work. You know, nowadays, if Matt Leinart, the quarterback for the Arizona Cardinals, and this really happened, is at a party with two co-eds. You know, he's a single guy. He can do whatever he wants. He's 23. If he's at a party with two co-eds in a hot tub and someone's there with a camera, it ends up on YouTube and Deadspin 10 minutes later. So the Cowboys used to, you know, occasionally hold position meetings in strip clubs. Can you imagine the golden video footage on YouTube, 5 or 6 of these guys sitting in a strip club having a lap dance while they talk about the 3-4 defense and how they're going to play it against the Seahawks? You know, they played the 4-3, but you know what I mean? You couldn't apply that sort of way of living to the modern athlete, because a modern athlete has no privacy whatsoever.
As I said earlier, Jeff, late in the book, you present the image of a reformed, even glowing Michael Irvin dancing with his wife. And at that point, he's apologized to some of the former Cowboys he earlier mocked because they wouldn't join the drug and prostitute parties in which Irvin participated, some of which, in fact, he funded. What are some of the players who did party with Irvin up to these days?
Kenny Gant, who was a safety, a very good special teams player, I visit him in Tampa, and he works a warehouse job. He has this horrible shift where he gets in at like 1 in the morning and works till 9 in the morning at a warehouse in Tampa. Nate Newton does some TV work in Dallas, and his son is a running back at the University of Texas. Clayton Holmes is a saddest story. He was a defensive back with the Cowboys. Again, gifted athlete, couldn't really handle it. And he was homeless in Florence, South Carolina, the town he was from. And I always thought it was the saddest of all the sort of what happened to of these guys, because he was a guy who made it, who made his money, and he's right back where he started. He was living in his mom's sort of a shed behind her house. And every time he would walk around that town, people would mock that guy. There's a guy who had the golden ring and dropped it.
I imagine that by now some of the Dallas Cowboys about whom you wrote have read Boys Will Be Boys. Have you gotten any sense of how they feel about the book?
Yeah, I've talked to a couple. I don't think Emmitt Smith is that happy. but you know what? Emmitt Smith didn't talk to me. And I have to say, you know, there are guys who didn't talk. And you know, Emmitt Smith kind of expressed a certain, who are you to write about our team? You know, what right do you have to write about our team? And I find that actually offensive, because I'm a journalist. More than anything, I'm a sports fan. I love sports. I was brought up in Mayo Pack, New York, being brought to the public library, raised on sports biographies. And my dad used to come home with 10, 11 at a time in a big stack. I love knowing what goes on behind the scenes of sports teams. I love what the life is like. And I know people want to read about that. And if you're going to say the Dallas Cowboys made history by winning 3 out of 4 Super Bowls, well, we have a right to cover history, even if it's sports history. And we have a right, just like we have a right to know what goes on behind the scenes at the White House or the Pentagon or whatever. We have a right to know what goes on behind the scenes in sports. And I think it's a fascinating thing. It's not an insulting look. It's, in a way, an admirable look, because I think it was fun. It's like looking back at fraternity days, not looking back at anything so, you know, horrible or anything that's to be condemned.
Jeff Perlman is the author of Boys Will Be Boys, The Glory Days and Party Nights of the Dallas Cowboys Dynasty, published by Harper. He joined me from the studios of NPR West. Jeff, thanks very much for speaking with me.
No, thanks for having me.
It's Thursday evening, September 11th, almost 7 o'clock, at the Spelman Museum of Stamps and Postal History on the campus of Regis College in Weston, Massachusetts. 11 former U.S. Olympians are preparing to talk about their experiences. The most veteran among them, Joe Warren Madden, was an alternate on the 400-meter women's relay team that ran in Berlin in 1936. The youngest is Jared Shoemaker, a triathlete who's still a little jet-lagged. He's just returned from Beijing. Bob Cleary, who played on the U.S. ice hockey team that won gold at the Squaw Valley Games in 1960, is here too, and the organizers have begun to worry that he may be late getting downstairs for the main event, a panel discussion, because Cleary won't shortchange a kid who's asking him questions about his experience.
Did you enjoy when they raised the flag?
Absolutely. That's what the Olympic is all about.
They raised the American flag?
Yep. It's not because of what I did.
It's
America won is what counts. That's it.
Eventually, the young man runs out of questions, and Bob Cleary makes his way downstairs toward the long table where he will join the rowers from the 96 games in Atlanta and the 92 games in Barcelona and the 84 games in Los Angeles, as well as the bicyclist who competed in Tokyo, Mexico City, and Munich, and the high jumper who won medals at the 60 and 64 games. Before he gets there, Bob Cleary wants to make a point about the Olympics that transcends the medals and even the competition.
Well, let me speak mostly about the Russians. We played them 15 times between 59 and 60, and we became friendly. I befriended two or three of them very, and we used to have a little vodka after, you know, whatever it was, and they were terrific people, absolutely wonderful.
The Olympians were gathering to talk, of course, to relive memories and to answer whatever questions the members of the audience might have. But according to Henry Lucas, the education director at the Spelman Museum, whether they knew it or not, the Olympians were also appearing on behalf of stamps.
It's a big topic. Almost every country has issued at least one or two stamps honoring the Olympics. It's a great way to publicize their own teams, their own activities, and it's just something that collectors like. And the exhibit we have upstairs go way back to 1896, which was the first modern Olympics, and the Greek stamps were sold to raise money to hold the Olympics.
The historical connection between stamps and the games notwithstanding, the idea for this evening's panel might never have occurred to Henry Lucas if he hadn't recently visited a senior center in Woburn, Massachusetts, to invite the residents to come see those Olympic stamps.
And a gentleman in the audience said, oh, we have an Olympian here.
The Olympian was Joe Warren Madden, and Henry Lucas was impressed.
I didn't believe she was at the 36. She was just looked so young and full of life. And so from that, I said, well, maybe we ought to, and her story would be interesting.
Actually, stories plural, and some of Joe Madden's stories are set in the days before she and her 400-meter teammates even got to Berlin. She recalls for the audience that it took a week and a half to get to Europe and that she and her teammates would time their training runs on the boat to coincide with the weightlifters' workouts on deck. Once they reached the site of the games, Madden was housed in a dormitory adjacent to the stadium. Each time she entered or left the building, she had to show her identification badge to Nazi soldiers, some of whom seemed less concerned with security than they were with convincing the athletes that Adolf Hitler could control the weather.
And it was showery season, if you listen to the Germans, that it never rained when he was there. So we soon got wise that if he was outside and it started to shower, they didn't bring him in. If he was in, they took him out. And then at that point, the German who would be sitting in your next row would say, see, he controls the weather.
Though Joe Madden and her teammates could not miss the fact that in 1939, Germany was a nation preparing for war, she was shocked by what eventually happened in the nation where she had left with the security guards.
It was hard to believe that we had, of course, I was, what, 21 and carefree, and it was hard to believe that this was the same country that had really put out the welcome mat.
Madden, the storyteller, was also a good listener. When Bob Cleary began to discuss some of the differences between the contemporary Olympics and the 60 Winter Games in Squaw Valley, Joe Madden trumped his hard luck tale.
I mean, I get $5 a month for laundry. I mean, that was it.
You were lucky you got fired.
You're right, I was lucky.
Eventually, the members of the audience had the opportunity to ask questions, and some of those questions were about money. Jared Shoemaker, the triathlete, said that he'd had to be satisfied with an appearance on the Wheaties box, which most of the audience felt should have been sufficient. Several people in the audience were curious about what happens when an Olympian finds he or she can no longer compete at the elite level, especially if they haven't made it to the Wheaties box. Adam Holland, a member of the U.S. rowing team in 1996, tried to answer the question by referring to the several athletes who'd competed in more than one Olympics.
The reason we keep coming back is because there's nothing I'd rather be doing. I'd still rather be doing it. But it's literally every second of every day, because everything you do, you have to say, is this going to make me faster? Is going to sleep now going to make me faster? Is eating this going to make me faster? You know, everything. And then it's gone.
Despite the discussions of money and fame and the talk of how hard it is to walk away from elite competition, the most enduring images of that evening at the Spelman Museum were the recollections of exciting days and unlikely friendships. Now, 72 years after Joe Warren Madden traveled across the ocean to compete in Berlin, the Olympics are often criticized for how commercial and how political they've become, how rife with doping and chicanery. It was fine to be reminded on that evening at the Spelman Museum of how international camaraderie and the joy of being young and strong and competitive can transcend those concerns for a time. You're listening to Only a Game. The Kansas City Royals are at the bottom in the American League Central Division, heading toward what could be their fifth straight last-place finish, but Royals home games are still drawing an average of nearly 20,000 fans. Sam Mellinger covers the Royals and baseball for the Kansas City Star, and he's asked his readers why they still care. He joins me now from Kansas City. Sam, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the contest that you set up for your readers.
Well, I've got this blog that I try to update Monday through Friday each day, and as kind of the season went on and the games became less and less meaningful, you know, why are people still reading this? Why am I still doing this? So I just put it out there. tell me why you still come here, because I see the numbers on the blog, and I'm just, you know, why?
What was the tone of the reactions and responses that you received?
It was unbelievably positive. I mean, it was people writing in about their first ball game and the first time they walked through the concourse and saw the green grass and the scoreboard. There were a couple, you know, smart alecks. There was one guy that wrote in and said, I'm still watching because I bet my friend that they'd lose 92 games or something like that. But, you know, most of the people, they were saying, you know, I fell in love with this team when I was a kid. And, you know, it's hard to remember, but, you know, back in the days of the grainy video, the Royals were really good.
Would you like to read for us some of the more interesting comments?
Here's one that was pretty representative. With all the stress in today's world, I'm probably more relaxed watching a game at Kauffman with an adult beverage than pretty much any place else. I smile every time I enter Kauffman. I remember the past with my dad and enjoy the present with my boys. Mm-hmm. There's something about that, you know, when you get older and get married and you have kids and you have a mortgage and stuff like that. I think for a lot of people to come out to the ballpark, even with rising ticket prices, people are able to sort of block all that out and kind of go back to their childhood.
How bad does a team have to be and for how long before these romantics say, oh, the heck with it, I'm going to make basketball my escape or football or hockey?
The Royals are lucky in a couple senses in that, one, they do have, they're an expansion team, but they have been around for 40 years now, and they do have a very proud tradition in the 70s and 80s, and a lot of those guys are still around. And there's only one other team in Kansas City, and that's the Chiefs, and I think anybody that was unfortunate enough to catch that game the other day knows that, you know, there's not a lot going on there either.
That's just the marketing campaign is, it may be bad at Kauffman, but it's worse with the Chiefs.
Right, right. And there's a lot of people that would agree with that, too. It hasn't been that way in a long time.
Sam Mellinger is the national baseball writer for the Kansas City Star, and he writes the Ball Star blog at kansascity.com. Sam, thank you very much for joining me.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It would be an achievement of note for anybody to make it from Lhasa, Tibet via the Mount Everest base camp to Kathmandu, Nepal across the so-called backbone of the Himalayas. But Steve Colligan wouldn't be satisfied with achievement of note. He's looking for unprecedented. That's why he intends to make the journey on a unicycle. This will be 1,000 kilometers of unicycling across five mountain passes, Mr. Colligan has said, with the biggest descent in the world at 4,600 meters. Mr. Colligan, who has also unicycled along the Great Wall of China and down Mount Snowdon five times, says, "This will be my biggest challenge yet." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, if pigs could fly, they wouldn't have to run in races, but they can't, and so they do. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The Yankees will not be in the playoffs, and the old Yankee Stadium, which closes after Sunday night's game, is probably feeling insulted right down to its foundations about that. Still, Yankees shortstop Derek Jeter did give the old ballpark something to feel good about last week, right?
Strange they're making all this fuss over a baseball stadium that hasn't seen a world championship this century. But, yes, they found a way to mention a really big number and Lou Gehrig in the same sentence, so the Yankees are happy. Derek Jeter got his 1,270th hit in Yankee Stadium. He got to that number faster than Lou Gehrig did, but not quite as fast as Mickey Mantle did. And this is what the Yankee fans have to hang their hats on this year.
That's what it's come down to. Regarding the new Yankee Stadium, one politician, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, says it is, quote, a great project. Dennis Kucinich, D. Ohio, begs to differ. He finds in the new ballpark, quote, waste and abuse of public dollars. So is that just because he's an Indians fan?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think it's because he looks at corporations and sees waste and abuse. And after the last week we've had, I'm not entirely sure he's wrong. But this is, again, yet another element in the ongoing fight about public money for private entities like stadiums. I thought we'd turn the corner on this. I think we have in a lot of ways. But it doesn't mean that when it rears its ugly head again, people aren't going to yell.
Seattle is not going to the postseason either, but it's not because Ichiro Suzuki has failed the Mariners. When you match the consecutive 200-hit season record that stood since 1901, when it was set by one Wee Willie Keeler, you've really accomplished something, haven't you?
I love baseball records where you have like guys like that whose name is in them. And we just pointed out that the great thing about whatever it was that Jeter did that was so significant was you got to mention Lou Gehrig while you were talking about it. Wee Willie Keeler is a name out of the way dim past. And I will bet you a lot of cash money that Ichiro Suzuki doesn't have the faintest bloody idea who Wee Willie Keeler is.
The Milwaukee Brewers fired manager Ned Yost on Monday, Charlie. It struck many as odd. How unusual is it for a Major League Baseball front office to fire the manager when the team is still very much in playoff contention?
Well, the only analogy I can draw is when the New Jersey Devils fired Claude Julien right before the Stanley Cup playoffs a few years back. All indications are that they had a real Captain Queeg problem with Ned Yost in Milwaukee, and basically they didn't want the team wrapped so tight that they couldn't get through the pennant race. They're still caught in a really tough wildcard race in the National League, in which, except for the Cubs, there really isn't a very good team out there.
The Angels, of course, haven't been worried about making the playoffs for some time, and the Tampa Bay Rays, the Red Sox, the Dodgers, and the Cubs, as you say, are safe as well. Which one seems to you most likely to advance?
If you think I'm going to say anything bad about the Tampa Bay Rays right now, you're out of your mind. Every time I wait for them to fall, they don't do it. The Red Sox have set their pitching rotation up impeccably for both 5- and 7-game series. And, you know, I know the Angels have had a great season. I'm still not sure on them.
Charlie, how do you feel about the prospect of Major League Baseball conflicting with Christmas shopping next year?
This is ridiculous. November 5th? I'm not sure, but I'm reasonably sure that teams like the Boston Red Sox and the Chicago Cubs and the Milwaukee Brewers are going to be in contention for the playoffs. Now, unless you're planning on moving it to a neutral site, you're going to have real problems with night games in the upper latitudes.
It's Ryder Cup week, and the American and European teams floating like butterflies and stinging like bees yesterday. Why was that?
Against all odds, Muhammad Ali showed up at a golf tournament. I mean, he's from Louisville, so he's a local icon. Nick Faldo said, that's one of those Ryder Cup moments you can't put into words. One of those Ryder Cup moments? How many boxing world champions and international icons have shown up at the Ryder Cup in the history of the Ryder Cup who aren't named Tiger Woods?
In the Friday foursomes, the Americans jumped out to a 3-1 lead. What do you think? Will they sustain it in today's foursomes and tomorrow's singles play?
I have no idea because I don't know who any of the Americans are. But I'm willing to bet that since I don't know who any of the Americans are, I could say the Europeans will come back.
In last Sunday's game between the San Diego Chargers and the Denver Broncos, referee Ed Hockley made a bad call. How's that for an understatement?
Well, he admitted he made a bad call. He went to the coach and admitted a bad call. Norv Turner decided he wasn't going to accept the apology. He's going to get marked down a little. He's one of the NFL's most recognizable officials, at least in part because he seems to have arms he borrowed from Mighty Mouse. But, you know, he's going to have trouble in the postseason this year because this is a big mark against him. He called it on himself, and I give him enormous credit for that. Mike Pereira, the NFL supervisor of officials, said on NFL Network this week that he wants him back working this week. So apparently, you know, calling the foul on yourself, calling the penalty on yourself as they do in golf is the way to go here.
There is no mechanism, though, if a ref suddenly realizes he's made a mistake. They can't do anything about it on
the field,
obviously.
That's right. They can't do anything about it on the field. And they can't, and I mean, there's replay on certain very close, very tightly circumscribed events, and this wasn't one of them.
The NFL suspended Tampa Bay cornerback Elbert Mack for one game as a result of his hit on Falcons quarterback Matt Ryan last week. Does it appear to you that the league is finally, perhaps, serious about punishing players who level helmet-on-helmet hits?
Well, they're trying. I mean, you will hear howls from the old guard in the NFL, but they're particularly wary of helmet-on-helmet hits to quarterbacks. Because, number one, we've already got at least two of the marquee quarterbacks in the NFL out for the season, not on helmet-to-helmet hits. But secondly, if they didn't take this seriously, Congress was going to. And that tends to concentrate the NFL's mind wonderfully.
Charlie, there are many reasons for us to celebrate the start of the National Hockey League preseason, but a Wednesday headline about the Pittsburgh Penguins' plan to replace departed All-Star forward Marian Hossa is one of them, don't you think?
Yes, because we get to see the name, and I'm pronouncing it wrong, and I don't care, Satan, on the back of an NHL jersey again. Miroslav Shatan, as they say, is going to take Marian Hossa's spot on the first line of the Penguins, which means he gets to play with Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin. And I wonder how it happens that Marian Hossa no longer plays for the Penguins. Could it be Satan?
Charlie, I've seen you decked out in team colors from time to time, and if you're interested in Seattle green and yellow, I'm told it's a splendid time to visit Key Arena up there in Seattle.
90% off, which I think is souvenir shop lingo for take these plaguey things away from us. We don't even want to think about these greedy bastards anymore.
Meanwhile, would it be an exaggeration to say Oklahoma City is ready for the transplanted Sonics to begin doing business in their new home?
Well, 13,000 of them are ready anyway. They all lined up for the Thunder season tickets. And that's the way I'm going to say that team's name, Thunder, that way for the rest of the NBA season.
The only thing you said more loudly this morning is
Satan!
There we go. And finally, Charlie, this week, renowned Garden Stater Shaquille O'Neal was nominated to the New Jersey Hall of Fame. How do you think he'll respond to that?
How about being in the class with John Bon Jovi and Jack Nicholson?
Pretty good.
Wouldn't you love to sit at the head table when they all get inducted with Jack Nicholson and Shaquille O'Neal? That would be great.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website, onlyagame.org. Will Rogers once cautioned that you should never try to teach a pig to sing because it wastes your time and it annoys the pig. But as Only a Game's Ron Schachter discovered this past July in Janesville, Wisconsin, you can teach a pig to race.
The Rock County 4-H Fair is more old barnyard than old brickyard, and more inclined to award blue ribbons than victory laps. But that doesn't mean it's not race day here. Jerry Morse, wearing a shirt bearing the inscription Robinson's Racing Pigs, plays a recorded call to post about 10 minutes before race time. He's standing next to a long red horse trailer that does not house horses.
Don't try to turn around and nibble on the microphone again. These are pigs. They like to nibble, and if they see something different.
Morse reaches into a makeshift pen holding four of the Yorkshire variety.
So these are my Yorkies. They are 2 months old. As you see, they all know my voice. They're all knowing me. They all thinking I'm going to give them a treat right now. They know me as their treat master. I am the pit crew.
From June until November, Morse travels to state and county fairs around the country. At each stop, he sets up a racing oval lined with black and white checkered flags and a miniature grandstand. He lives in the front half of the trailer. Those four Yorkies and a quartet of potbelly pigs occupy separate stalls in back.
We try to keep our animals under 35, 40 pounds, and we try to work with them when they're babies. I have two-month-old right now Yorkies, just over two-month-old right now. The two-month-olds are nothing but legs, and they act like teenagers.
They won't stay teenagers and all legs for long. By October, some of the Yorkies will have grown beyond 100 pounds, en route to six times that weight. Although unlike their fellow livestock at this fair, they're headed to a retirement at their home base, a 10-acre farm in Fort White, Florida. Their trimmer pot-bellied counterparts will continue to race in coming years. Morse explains that training these pigs begins when they are 3 to 4 weeks old and revolves around the pursuit of an Oreo cookie.
The cookie is at the end of the finish line, which is at the back of the starting gate. It's a 150-foot track. They run around roughly 7 seconds. After a couple times, they know what's there, and the first one there is going to get the whole cookie. The loser's going to get the crumbs. That's just a fact of life.
So we're going to get these going right here, and we're going to put these guys in here one at a time. And they should go right where they're supposed to.
Before the run for the Oreo today, Morse leads four of the pigs into the starting gate, gently attaches racing silks and numbers to their backs, and appoints cheering sections among the more than 100 fairgoers, many of them children, ringing the track.
You got number one. You got Hillary Rodham Clintham. Then we got number two is next on the far inside track over here. You got Arnold Schwarzenegger.
There's also Racco Ribs Obama and George Bushhog in this stable, not to mention Brittany Spare Ribs and Tammy Faye Bacon. The 6 to 7 seconds it should take them to finish the race comes out to about 15 miles per hour, Morse calculates. Although he recalls a porcine version of Secretariat, who finished in 5 seconds a few years back.
They're in competition with each other. When they go around these corners, they'll kick up dust and they'll turn around and fight for that cookie at the end. They'll come right to the center of the track to get that cookie. If they're in first place, you're going to see them weave on over to the center of the track every time.
How do you handle the photo finishes?
I wash your nose real close to the cookie tray.
Come on, turn around here. You turn that way, you can turn around. That's my finger. And we got number four and number one out the front, followed by number three, number two, and then number three. Who's going to come over the hurdles first? It looks like number four is my leading pig, and it's coming around here.
The pigs will run five more times in shows spaced 2 hours apart. But there's more to their job. After each foot race, they'll become Robinson's paddling porkers, swimming the length of the 50 by 3 foot tank that runs along the infield of the race course.
One, two, three, go. There we go. Come on, let's go. One, two, three, follow.
Robinson's Racing Pigs, which claims to have pioneered the sport in 1985, is to pig racing what the Hendrick Motorsports and the Joe Gibbs Racing Teams are to NASCAR. Randy Ross, who runs the business, covers the National Fair circuit with five different teams and also keeps his eye on the competition, Cook's Racing Pigs on the West Coast and Johnson's Racing Pigs, now doing business as Swifty Swine. Ross says that going aquatic has given his pigs an edge.
Oh, well, we wanted to come up with something that was a little bit more unique that the rest of the pig races wasn't doing. And we noticed back at the farm that out in our pond in the hog wallow out there, the pigs, they get out there and play and swim all the time. And we said, well, why don't we just incorporate that into the show? You know, most people, when they think of pigs, they think of fat, lazy animals that lay around all day. And when they see these pigs jumping in the water, it's something different.
It's also something that at first drew the concern of several animal rights groups.
They were all up in arms that it was unnatural for pigs to swim, but we have since proved that that's not right. Pigs are natural-born swimmers, and they swim in the wild all the time.
Wayne Fleury, the president of the 75-year-old Rock County 4-H Fair, says that racing and swimming pigs have proved a popular attraction at a gathering which mainly highlights the animal husbandry and craft exhibits of young people.
You have to have lots of interest points on a fair. And so the pig racing fits in very nicely into the overall scheme we have of having areas for people to go to. Because if I come to the fair and I just look at my grandson's wood carving, and then that's the end of it. There isn't anything to do.
Racing fans here agree. Linda Dow is visiting from Indianapolis.
I've never seen pig racing, but we go to the Indy 500 every year, and there they drink the milk, and here they get the cookies, so I think it's a good combination.
Young daughter Erica chooses to think along the lines of thoroughbred racing.
It's pretty interesting because they don't have jockeys or anything on their backs.
And with these porcine competitors already two-thirds of the way to a triathlon, She considers the possibility of pigs on wheels.
Skates, maybe.
Okay.
Bicycles.
Another pig racing entrepreneur in the making. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Janesville, Wisconsin.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Erica Bailey, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Ron Schachter's pig racing photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from pig racer Jerry Morse.
A pig is the fourth smartest animal in the world, so you reward them and you give them plenty of love and they'll pretty much do what you want.
So, assuming that humans are the smartest animals, a few Oreo cookies ought to stabilize the U.S. economy. Maybe I shouldn't make that assumption. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.